also expressed their satisfaction with, in the first place, the departure of President Donald Trump, the man who took several anti-Palestinian measures, including recognition of Jerusalem al-Quds as Israel's capital in late 2017, moving the U.S. embassy there, and declaring the so-called deal of the century. This had led the Palestinian Authority to halt its political dealings with Trump's administration.
We don't expect to witness a great difference between U.S. administrations and the Israeli regime. But Trump tarnished U.S. image and harmed its interests in the region. I hope Biden can make the U.S. committed to international law. Biden and Trump differ in everything, in performance and reasoning.
Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who was among Trump's close allies around the world, waited 12 hours to congratulate Biden. But at the same time, he thanked Trump for taking U.S.-Israel ties to an unprecedented level. For Palestinians, a change of administration in the U.S. is not a promise of change in Washington's policy toward them. However, Palestinians do hope for a gain in Donald Trump's departure, as his term in office is considered the worst even among most hostile U.S. presidents. Muraqandi, Occupy Ramallah.
Coronavirus cases among the general population are rapidly increasing in the Gaza Strip as over 200 infections are being discovered daily. The first community spread of the deadly virus was detected in late August, and over 8,000 cases have been discovered so far. Health officials have sounded the alarm over the rising figures in the densely populated enclave.
The number of infections in the Gaza Strip is high, and we are extremely worried due to the rising number. We are doing our best to deal with the situation. We are working around the clock to detect infections.
The coronavirus has complicated the already dire humanitarian situation in the blockaded Gaza Strip. COVID-19 has threatened the socioeconomic welfare of nearly 2 million Palestinians living in Gaza as much as their health.
People here don't have access to preventive equipment because they are crash strapped. They can hardly provide food for their families.
People have been suffering from the Israeli blockade, and now the situation has only gotten worse because of the coronavirus pandemic.
The Israeli blockade in place since 2007 has had a devastating impact on the well-being of people in the tiny coastal sliver. Gaza's health sector is suffering from acute shortage in medicines and hospital supplies.
14 years of the inhumane Israeli blockade on the Gaza Strip have taken their toll on the humanitarian, health, and economic situation. The Israeli blockade has left the health system in Gaza in ruin, making it unable to deal with the coronavirus pandemic.
The coronavirus is fast spreading in the Gaza Strip, and people fear the worst because of the high population density.
As infections continue to rise, rights groups are calling for the complete lifting of the Israeli blockade to help fight the spread of the deadly coronavirus. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
The head of the UK Armed Forces has warned if current smaller conflicts escalate out of control, drawing in more countries and weapons, World War III might break out. In a Remembrance Day interview with Sky News, General Sir Nick Carter said the world is currently, quote, a very uncertain and anxious place.
We have to remember history might not repeat itself, but it has a rhythm. And if you look back at the last century, before both world wars, I think it was unarguable that there was escalation that led to the miscalculation, which ultimately led to war at a scale we would hopefully never see again.
General Carter says that the British Army will comprise 90,000 human soldiers and 30,000 robots by the 2030s. And aside from modernizing and amplifying its own military, the UK is still the world's second largest arms exporter.
Military arms deals worth an estimated £39 billion were approved between 2008 and 2017, a third of which went to countries with abysmal human rights records.
But we have not seen any evidence of that. If we stop selling them the bombs, if we stop selling them the planes, that will have an impact on Saudi and on what Saudi can do in Yemen, because we are one of the main exporters of arms to Saudi Arabia, and frankly, we can't make bombs fast enough for them.
The UK currently has £11 billion worth of orders. So how does stockpiling and exporting arms factor into the UK's World War III game plan?
The UK government has spent hundreds of billions of pounds, large amounts of which have yet to be properly even accounted for, in response to the coronavirus crisis. And General Carter knows full well, I suspect, as do many others in government, that at some point a reckoning for this is going to come, and this money is going to have to be found somewhere, either through tax rises or more likely through departmental budget cuts. And that time is fast approaching, when indeed the British government, as indeed other governments, are going to have to start doing the mathematical reckoning for their spending. And so I think possibly what's the motive here for General Carter as head of the UK Armed Forces to remind yet again for the message that is constantly being put out by the think tanks and the media that support strong armed forces, that is that the world is a dangerous place.
The world is still reeling from the results of the presidential elections in the US, undisputedly the world's military heavyweight. And although Donald Trump's four-year term was the first without a new war since Eisenhower, his administration has allowed military voices to shout down those of experienced civil servants in the development of foreign policy. Funding cuts to non-defense federal agencies and many career civil servants resigning means policy planning is being entrusted invariably to those in uniform. Bianca Rahimi, London.
On Friday, taxi drivers went on a one-day strike nationwide, calling the government's attention to the economic plight they're facing following the pandemic crisis and the connected restrictions. Unions also called two protests held in front of the Economy and Transport Ministries, attended by thousands of taxi drivers from across the country. Drivers are demanding more support from the government as, quote, they don't have the money to pay the monthly costs of the vehicles, nor to provide for their families.
Gli aiuti ricevuti sono assolutamente insufficienti.
The subsidies we have received from the government so far are totally inadequate. €275 each month is not sufficient. How are we supposed to put food on the table for our families? Consider we have suffered losses in the range of 80 to 90%.
Non torna ai 3.600 euro.
Io ho ricevuto.
My income has dropped by 80%, but all expenses have remained unvaried. Insurance fees, fuel and car disinfection costs have not been reduced. Furthermore, the government is doing nothing to stop illegal cabs from going around.
È molto alta.
A new three-tire restriction system came into force on Friday. As a result, four Italian regions, namely Calabria, Lombardy, Piedmont and Val d'Aosta, have been placed in soft lockdowns. The government has also imposed a nationwide curfew from 10 p.m. until 5 a.m., requiring all museums and galleries to shut down and all shopping centers to close on weekends.
Protests against the new anti-COVID restrictions imposed by the government have been staged in a number of cities across Italy. Some demonstrations turned violent as protesters vented their frustration and anger over how the pandemic crisis has been handled.
The virus is a moving train. Today it is necessary to slow it down, otherwise the train will knock us down. We are hopeful that these measures will be limited to several weeks.
The new restrictions imposed by the Italian government apply for about 4 weeks, until December 3. Max Civili, Rome.
On the 14th of March 2011, Bahraini security forces began a violent crackdown on protests demanding greater political participation, free and fair elections, and an end to corruption and equality for the country's suppressed Shia majority. It has now been revealed that the UK's top military officer, General Sir David Richards, was in Manama holding meetings with the country's senior military officials and the Crown Prince 5 days earlier. In the brutal crackdown, Bahrain security forces were backed by 1,000 UK-trained and equipped Saudi troops. Since then, almost all prominent human rights defenders and dissidents have been jailed, silenced, or forced into permanent exile. The main opposition party, Al-Wefaq, has been dissolved, and the country's only independent newspaper, Al-Wasat, forcibly closed down. Torture is widespread in Bahrain's prisons, especially for the purpose of extracting confessions that are used to sentence people to death.
and the country has the largest number of political prisoners in relation to population.
We have interviewed people, men, women and children, who have been tortured by the regime. Children who have been snatched from the streets by armed gangs and have been then beaten and driven around the streets. One boy had his teeth knocked in. And they are forced then to inform on family members or friends or people that they know in the villages who have attended democratic protests or have attended political gatherings. Inside the prisons, people have been waterboarded. They've been beaten with truncheons on their bare bodies and on their feet. They've been hung for hours, days, and deprived of sleep. They have been anally raped with truncheons. They have been just the cruelest, most inhumane treatment.
Nonetheless, the British government continues to support the regime. When construction began on a new permanent naval base in Bahrain in 2015, then UK Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond said this.
This will give us the flexibility to respond to any emerging challenge in the Gulf, whether it's from a state actor or a non-state actor, whether it's from within the Gulf or outside the Gulf. This enhances our range. It gives Britain a permanent naval base east of Suez for the first time since 1967.
Strategic interests seem to be Westminster's priority. According to Human Rights Watch, arbitrary arrests, torture, executions and forced disappearances continue with very little interference from so-called democracies. Bianca Rahimi, London.
With the name of martyr Qasim Soleimani decorating the Persian language department at the University of Sana'a, the first graduates of the department walking down it, reviving the memory of Haj Qasim, who they carried his name as a title for their badge.
When we talked about the Persian language, it was impossible to learn it because of the international fight against it, and whoever spoke it was considered as the enemy of Islam. Today, however, we have proved to the world that we and the Iranian people are brothers, and Islam unites us.
Graduates expressed their overwhelming joy of this accomplishment, stressing that their choice name for the Soleimani badge comes at a critical time in light of American unilateralism, reaching its peak.
Martyr Soleimani's efforts in the region and his support for the Palestinian cause requires us to revive his memory by naming a badge in his name.
The ceremony came after Hassan Erlu presented his credentials to the President of the Supreme Political Council, Mahdi al-Mashat, as ambassador of the Islamic Republic of Iran to Yemen. This shows the depth of the Yemeni-Iranian relations, especially with the U.S. escalating its hostile policies towards the two countries and towards the resistance axis as a whole. Erlu's predecessor left Sana'a in September 2015, and in October last year, Iran's foreign ministry said the process of sending a new ambassador was hindered by attacks on the embassy.
While some Persian Gulf Arab states leaders rushed to normalize relations with the Zionist entity, Yemenis continued to reaffirm their support for the Palestinian cause. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech of Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the birthday of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family.
The resistance at the beginning of Beisat resulted in 3 years of unbelievable resistance in Shaybe Abi Talib. Children cried through the night out of hunger. The sound of their crying could be heard in Mecca, and some of the kind-hearted disbelievers of Quraysh felt sympathetic towards them, but no one dared to help them due to their fear of the powerful. That was while the faith of the early Muslims, whose children wasted away before their eyes, there were many people who died there, many were plagued with diseases, and many suffered from starvation, was not shaken. The commander of the faithful, alayhi salam, told his dear son, Muhammad ibn al-Hanafiya, "The mountains may be shaken, they may be removed, but your faith must not be shaken." That was the same piece of advice that the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family gave in his testament. That is the way the Islamic Ummah must rise up. That is what the basis of the Islamic Ummah means. That is the lesson that the Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family taught us. That is what Basit teaches us.
Your light and love, all I see. Nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
We say that the holy existence of the great Prophet and Messenger of Islam, peace be upon him and his family, is the most important point in creating unity. We have said before that the world of Islam can meet at this point. This is a point where the emotions of all Muslims are connected to one another. This is the center of love and affection in the world of Islam. Of course, you can witness that in the present time, some authors who are financially supported by the Zionists pay attention to this center and insult it. They do this so that the importance of insulting the Islamic Ummah and humiliating the world of Islam diminishes. This is the main point.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of halim, please.
Hi,
Hi, sir.
Hi, kitty. Good morning.
Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Hello and welcome to another edition of The Debate. President Donald Trump has every right not to concede the presidential election and Americans should allow the election process to unfold. These were the words of Senator Mitch McConnell on the Senate floor on Monday, as he declined to acknowledge Joe Biden's victory and said that Donald Trump has every right to look into allegations and request recounts. Meanwhile, the U.S. Attorney General, William Barr, has authorized federal prosecutors to begin investigating irregularities. In this edition of the debate, we will investigate what all of this means for the U.S. And to begin with, we are joined by our correspondent to give us an update.
Yeah, so right now there are several legal challenges that are happening across the nation as the president seeks to refute some of the election results. And we're looking at some of those battleground states like Michigan and Arizona, Nevada, and of course, Pennsylvania. These are all states that were key in the president-elect's victory in trying to achieve that magic 270 number, which means that he received most of the votes in the electoral, he would receive most of the votes in the Electoral College. And the reason why I made that correction just now is just because the president-elect reached 270 doesn't automatically make him president. Once the votes are certified in every state, then the Electoral College votes on the results, then he officially becomes the president-elect or the president of the United States. So there's still a little bit of a process here, but the current president is putting that on hold as he tries to, again, dispute some of these election results. He believes that he is the winner. Whether or not he really believes that, that remains to be seen. But for right now, he's putting up legal challenges across the nation, holding up the process, making it very difficult for the transition team to go through the proper process to go into the presidency in 2021.
Thank you very much. That was our correspondent Colin Campbell from Washington, D.C. Now, to continue this discussion, we're joined by senior geopolitical analyst Patricia DeGennaro from Washington, D.C. Also, thank you very much for joining us, ma'am. With the support that Trump has, how far do you think these allegations can go?
I don't think they can go very far at all. I mean, the results have come in. We've had more people participate in this election than we have in history, which actually is a very good thing. And I think what the president should be doing is taking advantage of the opportunity to really embrace the democratic process and how it's gone through right now. I mean, he had a substantial amount of votes. He still didn't win the popular vote, and he still does not have all electoral votes. In any other time in history, This is just an unprecedented type of behavior, but what else would we expect from this administration?
Thank you very much. Let's go to our other guest right there, editor of Veterans Today, Mike Harris from Phoenix. If you could please tell us what you think with the support that Trump has, do you think he will go very far with these allegations, or will it just stay in the news?
Oh, absolutely. Trump's going to take this all the way to the Supreme Court if needed. What we're witnessing here is the attempt of a theft of the election by the Democrat Bolshevik Party that is taking over, trying to take over the U.S. That and the resistance of the deep state. There's collaboration with the major media. There's collaboration with the social media. And this is not to be tolerated. The American people have had enough. You know, we've been lied to by our government for, well, since 1963 when they murdered JFK in broad daylight and said it was Lee Harvey Oswald and not a conspiracy. And so we figured it out. We understand that the government lies and the media lies and that we're no longer going to tolerate it. You saw tremendous outpouring of support for Trump. I mean, 58,000 people show up for him at rallies. You know, Biden's lucky if he can get 12 and half of those are staffers. So we, as the American people, are not going to sit down and let this election be stolen from the will of the people by the chicanery that that the Democrats pull on a regular basis. I mean, they really haven't won a legitimate election in over 50 years.
I can see that Patricia disagrees with you. If you'd like to make any comments here before I ask the next question.
You know, I think it's really, as someone who's very nonpartisan, I think it's really irresponsible to make these kinds of claims. There are alleged claims, even in Pennsylvania, where I happen to actually grow up through this out of the courts. I mean, the election wasn't stolen. There's no evidence of that. And I really think as a society and to support the American democratic process, we are undermining our own system here with comments like you're making. And I it's a very, very dangerous precedent to make. You make it now, it will happen in the future. This is not about Republican or Democrat. This is about upholding a democratic system. People voted, they expected their votes to be counted, they were counted, and this is the outcome. Now we have to accept the legitimate outcome. It will be verified, and I think it's premature to say all of the, you know, the critical elements that you're saying, and really, really claiming that people are fraudulent. I mean, can you prove that? Do you have anything to prove that?
Patricia, I'm sorry to cut you off right there, but Mike here mentioned the media and especially the role of social media. I'd like to know what you think. We can see, for instance, CNN is calling Fox News a television that's supporting Trump, and it's basically what the media is actually playing out here. Not facts that are being told.
Well, yes, and let me answer that question. I think the media is being completely irresponsible as well. I mean, they're jumping ahead. They're fighting battles, and they're fighting corporate battles. If you want to talk about a deep state, you can talk about the people with billions of dollars who are influencing a government. That is your deep state corruption. And I'm sorry to say that a lot of the supporters out there are those. You know, Sheldon Adelson and others with billions of dollars. I mean, come on, there's your deep state, and they're supporters of Trump.
Thank you very much. Now let's go back to Mike. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has just said that there would be a smooth transition to a second Trump administration. What do you make of this comment?
Well, I think Pompeo is being very forward-looking, and I think whenever the final tally is done, Trump is going to have won. Now, we have to separate out what are the legal ballots from the illegal ballots. 2 days ago, Steve Pachinik came out and announced that there are quantum encrypted watermarks on all of the legal ballots, and that the National Guard is in the process of separating those out. 78% of those, of the first 14 million, have been for Trump. 25% have been for Biden. So as this thing shakes out and the illegal ballots are culled from the system, we're going to find that Trump had a resounding victory and that this is an attempt to steal it. Now, I do agree with Patricia that we need to get the big money out of there. We don't need to have the Sheldon Adelsons and the oligarch billionaires, whether it's social media or the gambling tycoons, trying to influence our election. This country is set up for the benefit of the American people. And that has been stolen from us. And
people
have resoundingly spoke out about their support
for
Trump.
It's not been stolen. I mean, that is just irresponsible discussion.
Well,
since
the media get to call the election? That's not the media's job.
They don't get to call the elections, but when do you or anyone else have the right to go around saying that the democratic process doesn't work and the election is stolen? It's not a stolen election. You can't prove that at this point.
It is an absolutely stolen election. The media does not have the authority to call the election, and yet that's what they're attempting to do. And the social media is censoring anyone who challenges what the mainstream media is saying.
I disagree with that, but I'm not going to sit here and say anyone has stolen an election without proof.
There is plenty of proof. Look at Bedford Law.
It is not plenty of proof.
Bedford Law, for example, does not support it. Bedford Law has been used in prior fraud cases to prove election fraud. Bedford Law completely applies to Wisconsin, applies to Michigan, Pennsylvania.
These are all Republican talking points.
It applies across the board.
You know, you're sitting here making Republican talking points, and if that's all that this discussion is about, I mean, it's not worth the time.
Okay, so Patricia, if you could please tell us, why is Mike Pompeo talking about a second Trump administration?
Because Mike Pompeo is just as irresponsible as all of the other people right now that are trying to undermine and disrupt a democratic system. I completely agree that we should wait for the GSA, the General Security Association, to be able to certify this election and, quite frankly, shut off the media if you don't want to hear what they're saying. But I think it is very irresponsible to try to undermine a democracy, to try to promote division currently, and to blame people for fraud before you can prove any of those things. It's unconscionable in my mind in a democratic society.
Okay, so Patricia, what we see here on this show, I'm sorry, Mike.
Patricia, on one point, please. Let me agree with her on one point. Protecting the process is the most fundamental thing that we as Americans can do. And when many of us witness blatant fraud, and it's obvious
fraud. No, it's not blatant fraud.
It is. We witnessed it on the election night. Fox News May I please finish, please. You don't need to interrupt. I mean, honest. Whenever Fox News called Virginia when only 8% of the tally was in, and yet they don't call Pennsylvania when 98% is in for Trump, there's a little bit of an imbalance there. And so
Why is it that your argument is that the media should not be calling the election, yet you're quoting the media that is calling the election? You do not have to listen to this. If we all want to wait for a valid count, we can wait for the system and the process to be done. Calling it fraudulent at this point is just incorrect. It's an allegation. And
well,
as
I respectfully disagree.
No, and I totally resent you, you know, questioning me as an American as well, and that's what you're doing.
So, Patricia, I'm very sorry, but let's continue this discussion. First of all, it's very interesting for me, looking from the outside of the United States, and you two both are Americans, it is very clear that your society is deeply polarized, and no matter what we bring up, the issue of election fraud comes up. I would like to know why this is the case, and is there a possibility that the election results are overturned, Patricia?
Well, the idea of fraud has come up because they're Republican talking points. That's the bottom line. And they continue to say them over and over to undermine democracy and influence thoughts and the processes of the population and the people. So, I mean, this administration has been expert at information and information influence. And they are, you know, they are right aligned with the social media. So I don't think at this point that this election can be overturned. I think that people have spoken. It's been very close, not quite as close as the last election, where actually Hillary Clinton did get the popular vote, and she could have, you know, claimed fraud as well. But, you know, we let the system play out. They welcomed Donald Trump into the White House, and it's a peaceful transition. That is America, and that is the society, and that is the system that we need to protect.
So do you think that the election results can be overturned?
Because they did not welcome Donald Trump into the White House.
Yes, they
did. The FBI, at Obama's direction,
was in there spying on
Donald Trump and trying to undermine
everything. Obama welcomed Donald Trump.
Obama was the first one to abrogate and to violate the peaceful transition by his actions against Trump. Everything they've done against
you know, sir, I'm not sure that you really understand politics or the process, or you're close to it.
Oh, really? Really? You're gonna lecture me? I was finance chairman for the Republican Party during the 1994 election cycle. All right, I ran for governor.
Well, then you see that the system needs to go the way it is for democracy.
Politics. I understand politics better than you ever will, lady.
Okay, and Mike, if you could please tell us what you think. Can the results of these elections be overturned? Is there a possibility for that?
Well, first of all, the election has not been officially called, so therefore it cannot be overturned. What's going to happen is the news media's call is going to be overturned. And we're going to find out that the legitimate winner of this election has been all along President Donald J. Trump. And not only that, but the down ticket votes are also going to be examined and audited. And we're going to find out other Democrats cheating across the board. And we might have some new people, some new faces in a number of these elections. And I'll look at the Senate race in Michigan, where the black gentleman, Jack, I forget his last name, was way, way, way ahead until they closed down at midnight. They woke up at 4 o'clock, and suddenly there's 100,000 new votes in there that didn't exist prior to that, when they're supposed to be closed. How is that possible? This is blatant, open, in-your-face fraud. And Patricia, if you can't see it, I'm sorry. You better take your blinders off or get new glasses, something.
Okay, so we really don't have that much time left. Patricia, no matter what the results of these elections, do you think that there would be a peaceful transition?
I hope there would be a peaceful transition. That is who the American people are, and that is how our society works. So I think we should wait for the elections to be verified by the correct agencies and administration, and I hope no one will prohibit that from happening or play politics to make that not happen. So I would think that if that does not happen, we are really in trouble as a country to not have a peaceful transition, which is our historical way of doing things.
Thank you very much. And Mike, your opinion, do you think that no matter what the results, so would there be a peaceful transition?
Well, I pray for a peaceful transition. I also pray for a legitimate election result that comes out, because right now the process, according to the media, is not legitimate. We have to wait for the process to run its course. However, I do fear that whichever way it goes, there's going to be some violence, because one side or the other is going to be inordinately unhappy with whatever happens, whoever is declared the winner. And so I really would like to see that avoided, but I would more importantly protect the process of the election and do not allow fraudulent and illegal votes to have the same weight as the legal vote of American citizens. That is not right. We have to defend the process and defend the legal vote against the illegal votes that the Democrats have propagated across the entire system.
Now, my final question for both of you is mostly with regards to the U.S.'s image across the world. The U.S. has always claimed to be a role model, especially when it comes to democracy. Now, how do you think these recent events have affected the global image of the United States? Patricia.
Well, I think it's hindered and it's really hurt the global image of America. I mean, a lot of the countries out there are just not looking at us like we know how to keep our own house in order. And we don't have a leadership that is trying to unite and prevent the violence. When Joe Biden was elected, when people thought Biden had won the election, there was actually a lot of celebration. So, I mean, I didn't see any violence, and I live right here in Washington, D.C., so there was no even view of violence. So I really think that we have to be positively supporting each other and bridge those divisions and understand that this is a democratic process and people lose and they have to transition out of office.
Thank you very much. And Mike, your opinion, do you think this has affected the U.S.'s global image?
Well, I think the U.S. Tarnished its global image going back to 9/11, when they never caught the real perpetrators and blamed it on 19 Arab hijackers to justify illegal wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's pretty obvious that the U.S. has been run by a cadre of gangsters for a very, very long time. It's time for Donald Trump to come in there and actually drain the swamp and clean house. I mean, if the U.S. has a bad image globally, it's because the management class who runs this country has created it. I mean, it is appalling what has happened to this country. This is not the country that I was born and grew up in, and it has been straight downhill ever since, since they murdered JFK in Dealey Plaza in 1963. This country has been on a downward trajectory ever since. And it's time for the American people to take it back and to restore the Democratic Republic in its rightful way by honoring the votes, the legal votes, not the illegal votes, not the attempted fraud, not the attempted coup. But it's time for that, and the America will restore its reputation around the globe very, very quickly once that happens.
Thank you very much. I'm afraid that's all the time that we have for this edition of The Debate. Senior geopolitical analyst Patricia DeGennaro from Washington, D.C., also editor of Veterans Today, Mike Harris from Phoenix. Thanks to both of you for taking part in this edition, and thanks for following this edition of The Debate.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
It is revealed that the actual number of migrant children and infants separated from their parents is significantly higher than previously thought, according to an email obtained by NBC News. In the email, Stephen Herzog, the lawyer leading the effort to locate the children's relatives and reunite the families, says that 666 children, about 20% of whom were under the age of 5, when they were ripped away from their parents, remain separated. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Brett Wilkins Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Lawyers Can't Reunite 666 Seized Migrant Children with Parents, 121 More Than Previously Believed. Here's the details of this article. Last month, the world was shocked and outraged to learn that lawyers tasked with locating relatives of child migrants seized by U.S. immigration agents under the Trump administration's zero-tolerance policy were unable to locate the parents of 545 children. Now it turns that the actual number of children and infants separated from their parents is significantly higher than previously thought, according to an email obtained by NBC News. In the email, Stephen Herzog, the lawyer leading the effort to locate the children's relatives and unite the family, says that 666 children, about 20% of whom were under the age of 5, when they were ripped away from their parents, remain separated. Herzog attributes the initial undercount to the fact that the U.S. government did not provide phone number contacts for 129 of the minors. We would appreciate the government providing any available updated contact information or other information that may be helpful in establishing contact for all 666 of these parents, Herzog wrote to Justice Department attorneys representing the Trump administration. Last month, the House Judiciary Committee released a scathing report revealing the U.S. administration knew it would not be able to reunite migrant families when planning the zero-tolerance separation policy, but implemented it anyway.
The Democratic-led committee spent 21 months investigating the planning and execution of the administration policy, which resulted in the seizure of more than 2,500 migrant children, including some with physical and mental disabilities, from their parents, the majority of whom are believed to have been deported from the U.S. Both parents and children, who were often told by U.S. officials that they would never see each other again, have suffered tremendous emotional and psychological trauma that Physicians for Human Rights has called torture and state-sanctioned child abuse. The federal government often separated families who presented themselves at U.S. ports of entry and legally requested asylum after fleeing violence and persecution in their home countries, much of it resulting from U.S. policies and actions. Some of the children have been given to U.S. families who are sometimes able to petition for permanent custody of them, and some of the children may indeed never see their parents again. In late June 2018, as public outrage mounted in the face of stories like a breastfeeding baby being torn away from her mother and a father driven to suicide after being separated from his wife and child, the U.S. administration reluctantly rolled back the policy, which, along with forced surgical removal of reproductive organs of migrant women, has been called the Trump administration's worst domestic human rights violation. U.S. President Donald Trump, on the other hand, continues to defend the separation policy while falsely claiming that deceased children were brought into the country by human traffickers. Biden has called family separation criminal, but has not said whether or not he would seek to punish Trump or any of the administration officials who planned and executed the policy. Lee Gillernt, the deputy director of the American Civil Liberties Union ACLU Immigrants' Rights Project, told the network that the new statistic includes individuals in addition to 545 for whom we got no information from government that would allow meaningful searches, but are hopeful the government will now provide with that information. The Department of Homeland Security and the DOJ did not immediately respond to a request for comment.
Of beautiful Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Thank you. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.